It's a great honor to be joined today by Dr. Wolfram Schultz. He's a professor of neuroscience at the University of Cambridge, a fellow of the Royal Society, and one of the world's experts in the study of dopamine neurons and their role in reward processing. Wolfram, welcome to the Nature and Nurture podcast.
Okay, hi.
We were talking a little bit about reward processing off camera, and it was so exciting that I wanted to wait to get to the recording before we finished explaining. But you started saying reward processing is present in all animals.
Yes, you find it in anywhere, in Drosophila, and you find it in rodents, you find it in all kinds of animals. Wherever you look, you find it. B, there's a reason why you find it. And the reason is how we define reward. Reward is what you need to live, right? Reward is what you go after. You're accumulating it. You're going towards, you approach it. And you learn from that to get more, right? So it's the basis of the survival of the individual gene carrier, so to say. An animal or a gene carrier who doesn't have a decent reward system will either not survive or it will not reproduce. And then the genes of that gene carrier disappear. And so I take a very, as you see, simple view of the reward system as being a key contributor to evolutionary selection or fitness, evolutionary fitness. So that means that as our brains have evolved over millions and millions of years from simpler brains, these simple brains already had reward systems. And we take these over, and nature, it invents new things, but does not reinvent things normally. It builds on existing things. That means we have still our ancient reward system that we need from the first day we were born to suck the milk from the mother's nipple. But our cortex is not up to scratch at that point, of course. Then we want to constrain our reward seeking by not going for the biggest reward and nothing else or something. If you want to think about reward, we need a bit more than just a simple reward approach generating system. We need, like in mammals, we need a decent cortex. And that cortex, as you were asking earlier, that cortex takes time to mature. Age, I don't know, where does it start? At age 2, age 3, people say the prefrontal cortex is mature before age 25 in humans. So you have a problem here. You have reward system that makes you seek reward, and you have a cognitive system that kind of makes balance your reward seeking. But that cognitive system comes in online a little later as your reward seeking system. Of course, it doesn't mature on the first day when you're 16 years old or something. It just matures gradually. So you have a lot of competition between the innate drive to get as much reward as you can get and the control that reward seeking behavior by far more complicated systems like the cortex, which of course has far more complicated neural machinery. If you just look at the neurons and the dendrites and everything in the cortex compared to, let's say, the dopamine neurons, which are the very basic reward system.
I should say
the dopamine neurons by themselves are very complicated as well. Probably as complicated as the cortical neurons, but they're just much less, and they're much less connected to the brain than compared to the cortex. Much more straightforward machinery, despite all its complexity.
There's a related line of argument here by affective neuroscientists, people like Antonio Damasio, that consciousness boils down to emotion, and reward and punishment, approach and avoidance, positive or negative valence, are these all the same systems? When we say reward versus punishment, is that fundamentally the same thing as positive or negative affect?
The reward system and the avoidance system is not the same. In fact, the dopamine system is not involved in avoidance in the larger sense. It will be involved of not going to smaller rewards when larger rewards are available, but they're not involved in running away from pain. You would have another avoidance system, and it's probably not as simple as the dopamine reward system. is a wiring system. It certainly involves the amygdala, the famous fear responses to the amygdala, but the amygdala itself is a way bigger structure than the dopamine. And I'm not sure for what else you need. You probably need more than that for avoidance than just the amygdala. Whereas the dopamine system, you can stimulate the dopamine neurons and the animal go for the stimulation again. So the dopamine excitation is enough to make an animal go for a reward. That is the, by definition, the reward that you try to get, something you try to get again. And that is the dopamine stimulation. Now, when it comes to emotion, I think emotion is one aspect of reward, positive emotion. I'd say pleasure. It's an immediate sensation, subjective sensation that goes over if you have it for longer in a state of happiness. Happiness is a state, right? And become gradually happy because you have repeated pleasure. So once you know all this, you may develop a desire not only to become happy, but also to find something that makes you happy. If you like salad, you want to try out the salad, you do a salad again, you feel really happy because it's a very nice feeling to eat salad, at least for me. And then you desire the salad again. Now, of course, when you experience the salad, you feel pleasure. But the question is probably a decent speculation that a lot of stuff we do when we go after rewards, we're actually seeking pleasure from the rewards. But if you're really hungry and you find something to eat, I'm not sure it's all pleasure that drives it. It's literally the sense of deprivation. You don't have enough sugar in your blood, maybe sensing somewhere, even not subjectively, not consciously, but you might somewhere sensing that you're lacking amino acids in your blood or fat in the blood or something. So I think pleasure is a good common denominator that would explain why you are seeking rewards, but I'm not sure it explains everything.
The salad is a really nice example because it's not only the reward of ingesting something nutritious, but there's this abstract thought of, I'm being healthy. This is so good for my long-term health. Whereas if you ate a sugary donut, in the moment, physiologically, the sugar would trigger a bunch of dopamine spiking as well, right? But then...
Always. Definitely.
So would it be right to think about there's maybe subcortical unconscious activation directly in response to something physiological, like the amount of sugar. And then there's a separate cortical system about your metacognition, how you actually think about feeling bad about eating the donut or feeling good about eating the salad.
Yeah, I don't do that dichotomy between subcortical unconscious and cortical conscious processing. I understand that that's in the mind of many people. I'm an experimental neuroscientist. I want to measure things. How can I measure consciousness? I can measure conscious states like being awake or sleeping, but how can I measure consciousness other than asking the people how they feel about it, what they feel or something? I don't know. I think I'd rather not reply to that question. And I see that you're trying to make these definitions. I don't know. Okay. That's probably not wrong, but I just don't feel comfortable to say, yes, that's what I need.
Ignoring the dichotomy, what is different about the type of, say, dopamine firing when you ingest something sweet versus when you're thinking about something very abstract and gratifying, like sticking to your diet?
That's precisely what we don't know, because we don't know dopamine neurons in humans. We only know dopamine neurons in animals. And then we cannot say whether they're dreaming or something, or not dreaming, or imagining a reward or something. This is something that I'm thinking I like to do in humans. There are, in certain situations, neuronal recordings possible in humans, maybe less in dopamine neurons, but in the amygdala. And in fact, I have a plan in the next couple of years to work with people that have experience in recordings from humans in certain diseases or reasons of exploring the diseased brain before they undergo an operation. That's a perfectly legal, ethical approach. And in that case, you can tell the humans to think about a reward. So imagine you are thirsty. It's hot outside, 100 Fahrenheit. You didn't drink anything for 3 or 4 hours. And somebody comes with a cold glass of water, a glass of cold water. Imagine what would happen to your reward neurons. We know there are reward neurons outside of dopamine neurons, like in the amygdala or so. And I would really like to know, at least those reward neurons I can look at, what they would be doing in these situations. And then I could compare them directly with the same individual person receiving a drop of water, maybe not in 100 Fahrenheit environment because they would be in the hospital, but there's some kind of a situation in which we can compare between the actual reception of reward and the imagined reception of reward. I would not be surprised if, at least in the amygdala, which is a fairly complicated structure, that we would want it. And maybe in the dopamine neurons as well. I wouldn't be surprised. Although the dopamine neurons are more basic, they're more down, they're basic, they're almost brainstem. They're more basic than the amygdala, far less complicated and complex, far less sophisticated. Difficult to say. If you ask for dopamine neurons, difficult to say. If you ask for amygdala neurons and orbitofrontal reward neurons in the base of ganglia, I could imagine that at least some of them would be active both with the actual receptor of reward and with the imagination of
it. We're taught that all neurons are fairly simple. They're binary. They either fire or don't fire. What does it mean for one type of neuron to be simpler or more complex than another?
Oh, no, the firing or the not firing, that relates to a time base of a millisecond. That action potential has a duration 1 to 5 milliseconds. And within that duration, the action potential will occur or will not. So that's a binary event. But what we're looking at when an animal sees a reward, like a drop of juice, there are more of these action potentials per unit of time. And unit of time could be something like 50 milliseconds or so. So there are more or less neurons within this interval, 5 milliseconds, then you would say the neuron fires more or less, or the neuron has a stronger or weaker response. And then you had a second part of the question.
About complexity. So if it's firing more, is that because it's simpler and it's easier to activate, or the other way around?
No, by complexity, the connection with other neurons, the dendrites receive information from axons from other neurons, and these can be completely different neurons. They could come from the cortex, they could come from subcortical areas, or they could come from neighboring neurons. And there could be many synapses, there could be less synapses. The synapse can be effective. That means if there's an action potential that goes on an axon into a synapse, then the so-called postsynaptic neuron will also have an action potential, or there may be, which would be more complex, only very small effects of an action potential that comes in, and you need five action potentials from different inputs to produce one postsynaptic action potential. So that's what I mean by complexity, more the complexity of the information processing at the synapse, at the neurons. And do the neurons have always the same synapses? Do they have different synapses? Do they have many dendrites? Do they have few dendrites? Are the same dendrites? Are the dendrites always contacted by the same axons from other neurons, or are they completely mixed up? That's what I mean by complexity. Nothing to do with the action potential itself when it fires in response to a reward.
And dopamine neurons are simply wired compared to other parts of the brain?
I just said that. Yes, I realized that. Now, we know there are about 35 different inputs to dopamine neurons from different areas. So that is very complex. But the dopamine neurons, they don't come in layers like the cortex. When you look at these old anatomical slides from the 1970s, 80s, with these beautiful diagrams from the cortex, that's a far more complicated structure. And these dopamine neurons, that's basically a bunch of neurons in a half a million neurons on each side of the human. The cortex have, 50 billion neurons on each hemisphere in the humans. So there are more neurons, there are more layers of structure, there are far more different types of neurons it's a totally different system, the cortex, compared to the dopamine.
Now, most human neuroscience research that I'm familiar with is neuroimaging, where you're looking at huge swaths of brain area light up, and it could be millions of neurons. And it sounds like the type of research you're referring to is invasive research looking at individual neurons firing that can only be done in animals. What do you get out of that more fine-grained approach that you can't do in neuroimaging?
The processing unit of the brain is the neuron. It's not quite like the atom, maybe it's like the molecule in physics or in chemistry. It's the basic thing. If you take that neuron apart, then you don't have a functioning brain anymore. And if you record from 10,000 neurons at the same time, you get some signal. You don't know if all 10,000 neurons produce a signal, or maybe only 500 contribute to that signal. There may be mixed neurons in between, some neurons to reward, some neurons to movement or something. Not the dopamine neurons, but the cortex, totally. The cortex, you get quite a mixture. But in different areas, different mixtures of neurons that do reward, movement, sensory, perception, stimuli, everything. If you want to understand the information processing of the brain, if you want to understand how the brain processes information, you want to look at the elements that are doing the information processing, and that is the neuron. You can split it down. You can even say it's the action potential, it's the synapse, or it's the neurotransmitter release. That is splitting it down even further, but we don't have a simple means to measure those, with a few exceptions. We can measure dopamine, for example, dopamine release, but you cannot measure all these other molecules all at the same time. You can measure action potential. This is a pretty good approximation of brain activity. The human imaging, they're looking at other questions. They want to see if a part of the brain structure is involved in something. But how the individual neurons do this, take a computer apart. In the old days, the computer had a couple of microprocessors and then a lot of memory and a few other chips. And you could take a probe, an electronic probe, like from Tektronix. You could fix it to one of the connections. You can see what kind of signal you're seeing on these wires that go in and out of these individual processing units. Nowadays, computers are all in one big microprocessor, one whole thing. You cannot get in there. But in the old days, you could go with an electric drone and see what is the signal. And actually, in my talks, I often show pictures like that, and you see all kinds of different signals. That's what the neurons are doing, right? You don't see that in human imaging. You have a totally different question you ask in human imaging. You ask, does the prefrontal cortex store memory or something? Is it involved in memory storage? The prefrontal, or some area of the prefrontal cortex. You're not asking what is the individual processor, the neuron, doing in this situation, right?
Earlier, you mentioned an example of reward where you're dehydrated in the desert, you get to quench your thirst, and that's super rewarding. And this seems like a good place to introduce the idea of prediction error or dopamine dips, where you could drink the same amount of water and physiologically it's the exact same, but it's that baseline state of being deprived that makes it more rewarding than if you drink it when you're fine and you don't really need it.
So I think there are two different things here. What you're referring to is satiety. Mm-hmm. If I'm in the desert and didn't drink for a while, I'm certainly very thirsty. If I just drank a pint of water, I'm no longer thirsty. And I would say I'm water sate. My reward value goes down with satiety. I'm not going to drink another pint of water. That means the water has lost its reward value because I'm sated on that water. It's got nothing to do with prediction, got nothing to do with prediction error. The dopamine prediction error is a totally different thing. If there is a reward that is predicted and the reward occurs, and let's say it's tangible, let's say it's a drop of water that has been perfectly predicted at that moment to occur, then your dopamine neurons will fire.
This is making me realize that I don't understand satiety very well, because I think I was conceptualizing it as though you're satiated when neurons that are expecting some reward are misfiring and the reward signal no longer comes through the same way.
No, I think we would like to separate satiety from expectation and predictions. No, I think we're on the wrong here. No. Focal neurons are sensitive to satiety. Well, the evidence is actually not terribly strong. I would think they are sensitive to satiety from all I know about other reward areas where the evidence is much better, like autofrontal cortex, but that got nothing to do with the reward prediction error. The reward prediction error assumes two things. It assumes that there is a prediction and satiety got nothing to do with prediction. You could say I'm sated and I predict I get more reward. No, I don't think so. I think happened. Wrote that question before. I think at least I would like at the moment to separate satiety from prediction to avoid saying something wrong. The prediction on the dopamine neurons has two connotations. The first thing, something is predicted, and that can be, that should be in a quantitative manner. That means you should not just say, you're getting something to drink, but you should say, you get a glass of wine or something. Or a glass of water, stay outside of alcohol. And the second thing is specific for the dopamine reward prediction. It got to be predicted in time, which is overlooked. It got to happen at a particular moment. If you are in a pub and you're thirsty and you go to the bar guy and say, can I get a glass of water? Just plain water. I'll drink your beer after. And they go, yeah, I'll get you the water. And he turns around and he pulls you a little water in the glass and gives you the glass. I think the prediction occurs so slowly, there's no particular time that something would occur. You probably would not get much of a dopamine response. If, however, you're thirsty and you go in the pub and the guy turns around and holds a glass right in front of you, glass of water, I'm sure your dopamine neurons go bananas. Because it's a totally unpredicted event, and it is unpredicted in time, because you're not predicting that guy is turning around and give you a glass of water right in front of your mouth. So we can forget the temporal aspect of the prediction for the moment, because it makes things complicated, but it's often overlooked, and then people come to wrong conclusions. And we can prevent these wrong conclusions in our discussion by me being careful, paying attention. But what I want to say is the important thing with the dopamine neurons is the prediction. So if you know you're going to get a reward at a certain time and you actually get that reward, dopamine is nothing, absolutely nothing. If that reward is better than you think, for example, you know we have birthday. You buy it in a piece of birthday cake. You pretty much know your birthday cakes for the last several years because you've had birthdays before. But suddenly you buy that piece of birthday cake and it's so much better than anything you had expected. That drives the dopamine neurons nuts. They get really excited. You get 80-90% of dopamine neurons that immediately start firing 4 or 5 action potentials within the first 200 milliseconds, extra that they normally would not do. If that birthday cake is much less, or your nasty brother has put some vinegar into your birthday cake, you get a huge dopamine depression at the moment you bite in it because you're predicting the cake has a certain quality, taste, and everything, and suddenly it's terrible, right? So you get a negative provocation. That's what dopamine does.
And these predictions we are constantly making unconsciously?
We're making them. I don't know if they're conscious or not conscious. As I said, I can't do that. I cannot say that in animals. Yes, we always make predictions. Our brain makes predictions to the point of where we don't even need that word conscious. Everything you do right now, our discussion is producing predictions. I'm predicting where your head will be headed, directed. When I talk to you, you will not turn right or left because you have not done that in the past 10 minutes. So my brain does these predictions without talking about it, without I'm thinking about it. That is, and the predictions for reward are done by dopamine neurons. And that's why I say, I think they're done mostly unconsciously. They're just producing predictions. These neurons, this is called Pavlovian learning. If you ask me about it, I might recall them. Then, of course, it would become conscious. Yes.
Here, when we're talking about reward or that positive or negative affect being linked to how well your predictions are matched or mismatched, is that the same thing as consummatory reward, where it's immediately in the moment, as opposed to the type of reward that's more long-term, progressing towards a goal about the journey rather than the destination?
Very interesting. I think the long-term reward has a prediction. So, do I understand correctly, you're a graduate student or undergraduate?
Graduate.
Mm-hmm. Graduate student, right? So when you have your letter of acceptance for your graduate studies, your laboratory or whatever, your dopamine years were going through you because it may have been predicted, but you weren't very sure if it's risky. And it turns out to be actually true. You get a positive prediction error, right? If it's risky, mm-hmm. it's kind of 50-50 or whatever, you get a big reward prediction error. You get that because you get accepted for your PhD. But you know what it really means is your graduate studies are leading you to a later, more satisfactory life. At least that's what we hope. So down the line, you will have a lot of nice encounters when you're a student, your friends and everything. You will pass through maybe some laboratories that are interesting. And later you will have a nice profession and so forth. So this is a whole chain of events that starts in that case at the moment at which you receive that letter. And that is, this is a so-called temporal difference reinforcement learning model that assesses the value over a whole state, over a long state in this case, over several years. You may actually want to work with a bank where you get more money. And when you get a prediction, when you get a letter that you accept in the bank to earn a lot more money than you're doing right now, you may like that a lot. But if you think about the long-term consequences, it's that your salary in 10 years will not be more than a bit higher than right now. Whereas when you do your studies, you would have a much higher salary in 10 years. Of course, money is not everything. I just take it as a reward. So the idea is the immediate reward triggers a response. But if that immediate reward is part of a longer term beneficial situation that is also rewarding, then you get a much bigger reward response if that beneficial situation is better.
Is it true that depression is a failure to properly inhibit this cascade where, for example, you get a bad grade on an exam, so there's a negative prediction error there, and there's a hit of negative affect. Mm-hmm. And most people will just take that and say, okay, I'll try harder next time, everything will be fine. But in depression, it could cascade up this level of abstraction of, this means I'm going to fail my program. That means I won't be able to get a job. That means I won't be able to support myself. My life is ruined.
Yes. So what is the question?
Whether depression represents something like a failure to inhibit that prediction error cascade.
Yes. I think what you're saying is that the prediction error falls on the background of, I don't know, you call it a state of attitude. And that can be optimistic. Oh, the hell, I get a negative prediction error. Next time I'm going to do it better. Or the other is, I'm too depressed. I can't work. No, that is true. The prediction error falls on the background state, attitude, whatever you call it, depression being one of them, and they will have different consequences. The same reward prediction error has totally different consequences depending on how it is being used afterwards, right? You can use a hammer to put a nail in the wall, or you can use a hammer to smash a window because you lost your key at home.
This seems to imply that our predictions are all nested, and even something very proximal, like whether or not you get a drink of water in front of you, in this indirect way, it's connected to, am I going to be able to meet my homeostatic needs and live longer? And then all your plans in the future are in some indirect way attached to that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All these events, everything you're saying, everything you're seeing, comes onto the background, in the background, and then it gets evaluated. Take the other situation. Right, you talk to somebody and they tell you something, and you say, "Oh yeah, this is really interesting. I have an even better idea." So the person is the same method. So I'm saying, "I have a better idea. to the person who needs, oh yeah, let me hear it, I'll do it. Or, oh, what the guy says, I need it. Totally opposite reaction to exactly the same verbal information. Everything we do, every information we do falls onto a background and it is interpreted or yours in a way that is compatible with that background. The background decides often what you do with that information that comes in, right? The same information coming in is used in totally different ways. So I mean, we're not aware of that. We blur out something. Oh, we could do that. And the person is really mad or actually depressed. And you don't know why. What have I done? And it turns out the person is very sensitive and thinks everything you comment on is something the person has done wrong. It happens to everybody every day. Well, you want to be careful what you're saying. You don't want to hurt anybody. Even though the message itself is totally neutral.
That extreme negative sensitivity, again, it sounds like depression. And in the context of depression, you don't hear much about dopamine. You hear mostly about serotonin. So how are these systems similar or different? Do they work together?
I want to pull back a little bit. The depression is a state. And the state is supposedly caused or associated with too little serotonin. It has never been claimed much that it is associated with a lower tonus, lower level dopamine. But it has been said that depressed people appreciate rewards less, or at least use rewards less as encouragement. That means the dopamine system is producing the reward signal in the brain. It is not involved in the state that defines depression. It is reduced affective state. Dopamine is supposedly not involved in that. That's more serotonin, to some extent, noradrenaline, norepinephrine. But the dopamine, if one of the many symptoms of depression is to not value rewards very much, then yes, the dopamine reward signal is underappreciated in depression. That does not mean that dopamine is involved in depression. It's simply that a brain signal that comes from the dopamine neurons is not properly used in depression. Depression does not take account enough or properly of the reward signal coming from dopamine neurons. And depression takes not properly into account many other signals. They come from many other brain areas, right? The brain areas, including dopamine areas, are producing signals, and the depressed mind is not processing in a manner that's encouraging for the behavior of the individual person.
Does serotonin modulate that dopamine signaling?
Absolutely, yeah. But that may not mean much. In the brain, many neurotransmitter systems modulate each other. Yeah. There are some indications that serotonin neurons process reward, other indications that they process movement. Serotonin neurons are not a system like dopamine neurons, where they 80% process in one way or another, in a heterogeneous manner, admittedly, but process reward. Serotonin neurons do different things, different dopamine. Serotonin neurons seem to do entirely different things. There are very good studies, absolute excellent scientists that come to totally different neural signals in serotonin neurons. And that means something. That doesn't mean that the people make a mistake, but they mean that the system is very complicated.
I'm trying to piece together a story in my head about the timeline of these different types of predictions. It sounds like when we're talking about relatively short-term outcomes, like the food that you're getting in front of you or the grade that you receive on this test, that's more dopaminergic. And if you're thinking about something very abstract and long-term, like life satisfaction, I hear serotonin involved in that more. So first question is that, I know it's another dichotomy, but is there some truth to that? And then secondly, if so, is there some sort of translation between a shorter term dopamine action to longer term serotonin action?
I'm not sure about the life satisfaction and serotonin. What we can see is that there is an idea that the lack of serotonin is involved in depression, which means that you need a decent serotonin level to not have depression. That's at least the common understanding, and I'm not entirely sure whether every psychiatrist agrees with that. See, but the evidence that the serotonin is involved in long-term satisfaction in an active manner, not just by taking serotonin away and you have no more life satisfaction, but in an active manner, like you increase serotonin and people are more satisfied with their life. I don't know. I have not heard, but I don't know everything. I have not heard all this stuff. Serotonin is not my field. But I would be surprised if long-term satisfaction is involved. This is primarily based on serotonin. I think it's probably more a cognitive process where you have to have very good cognitive functions to understand your world, make good decisions, and as a consequence of that, your life satisfaction increases. I think there are some studies that correlate life satisfaction with particular neurons in a very high association cortex between, I believe it's between the insula and the orbitofrontal cortex, or the frontal temporal junction or something. It seems that the number of particular neurons in this area is correlated with life satisfaction. Again, I think this is a rather straightforward result, which does not reflect the complexity of life satisfaction, but it's a hint for what I think it's probably more the quality of the association cortex that determines life satisfaction. And these modulatory systems like serotonin and dopamine or so, they may have specific roles in that. If you have a bad dopamine system, you're not appreciating your rewards very much. You're bound to become depressive because you're not getting the satisfaction. But the role of dopamine itself in depression is by no means established anyway, other than by a few spurious results or something.
It's interesting that these top-down effects can seem to improve our mood, but only to a limited extent. So you can frame things in a more optimistic way, and that can improve your outlook. But if you start telling yourself just lies or delusions of grandeur, like I'm a God incarnate, and you say all of these amazing things about yourself having superpowers, and if they were true, you'd probably see massive dopamine firing, but very quickly reality seems to put those in check. So you can come up with any cognitive delusion, but your more basic processes would seem to inhibit those thoughts, maybe unless you have some form of psychopathology. Is that right?
Well, I think in general, yes. But you can use your deliberate thinking to be more crucial, to help people, to be the first smiling face of the day for people. They smile back at you. And you feel satisfied. So by deliberate decision to be pro-social, you get social response back that can make you happy. I'm not saying that all social makes you happy and all this. I don't want to generalize here, but I think you can. If you think I'm happy, man, that will not. No, I agree with that. But I think you can do some action that can indirectly make you happy. There's always these stories of people that are very religious, and they wake up and you say, oh, yeah, God will provide me a happy day. They go outside, they smile at people, and they say, everybody smiles back at me today. Isn't that a wonderful day? And all it took is to believe in God and believe that God is doing something good for you. That works. It is more complicated than just saying, yeah, I'll be a happy person. I'm a happy person. That won't. But to make a positive approach to life, including social life, which is a big denominator of your happiness, I think it can work. But I'm not saying that is the result of a good or less good prefrontal cortex or frontal cortex. If you have a bad cortex, you mess things up. You become frustrated. And frustration is certainly not producing happiness. So if you are always on the wrong foot, you're always irrational, you always do what everybody else would never do, you're not going to become happy. You can be productive. You can discover new things, but you're not going to become very happy. You become very happy when your stuff works, when you understand things, when you don't make idiotic mistakes, then you curse yourself afterwards for 2 days. That is what makes you happy. And for that, you can have the cortex. But just use the cortex to say, I'm happy today. I don't think that will work. That's not enough.
People talk about the human cortex being unique in its ability to plan for the future and engage in metacognition. And I know it's hard to study consciousness in animals, but looking at the basic neurobiology, the way the neurons are working in other animals, and if that's conserved across humans, can we get any hint of understanding whether animals are doing this type of metacognitive prediction as well?
I wouldn't be surprised. Maybe not the honeybee, maybe not the fruit fly, but I think mammals with their complex cortex. But there is a transition somewhere in the line of evolution of the cortex. The only animal that really have very well organized speech is humans. Monkeys, or not monkeys, apes can learn to communicate verbally, but what I'm hearing always is that not very spontaneous. They can be drilled, they can be trained, conditioned to use words, hundreds of words, but they're not, apparently not very spontaneous, that they suddenly come up with something. So I'm not sure. I think these animals have consciousness. Yes, no problem. What level of consciousness? I don't know. That's what we're debating. Whether they have metacognition is, in my opinion, a similar question as whether they have language or not. That means abstract language in which we can write about our own thoughts. That's metacognition, right? You can think about what you're thinking. I don't know if apes have that, which are probably maybe elephants, maybe whales, maybe dolphins that are the most developed mammals. I don't know. But the example of the language, of this fantastic language capacity that only humans have, makes me wonder how much we can simply copy-paste all our cognitive capacities onto other mammals. They surely have a lot of cognitive capacity, probably more than we think, and they probably have more consciousness. Oh, yes, I'm pretty much persuaded. I've been working with mammals for 40 years, 45 years. I'm persuaded they have consciousness. They can think. They can sit in the corner, think, and do something, but much, much less than apes. And much, much less than humans.
Would you say that it's similar to human children's level of cognitive complexity?
Maybe. I don't know. Human children are amazing. They're fantastic. I'm not sure whether the human infant is comparable to a chimpanzee, for example. I'm not sure of it. I think it's the human infant is an immature adult. It's not just a different adult. Chimpanzee is a different adult than the human adult. It's not the same thing. This is not very sure. I'm just speculating, and I'm trying to answer your question as honestly as I can without some speculation.
Do we know about how the reward system develops in humans from infancy? And I'm specifically thinking about, some people say that you have all of your neurons organized at birth and it's more about pruning and organization, but it's not like new neurons are being born, right? So do those dopamine neurons look mature from the start?
Well, I don't know.
And is that because we can't do the type of invasive cellular research in humans?
No, we wouldn't need to. As sad as it is, brains dead babies. To do that, to look at that. I'm sure this has been looked at. I just don't know that, how much they're differentiated. Let's go back to the reward system. These infants must have a reward system. Otherwise, they would never suck milk. But milk for them is a reward. The behavior they're showing from the first day on, when they're outside the uterus, is a typical reward-seeking behavior. I don't know that goes through the dopamine system in these small humans, but I would be surprised if it would not, because I don't know another system, be it efficient. So I think dopamine neurons are probably more or less function. They may not have all the dendrites well developed. They probably don't have the dendrites well developed. They may not be as sophisticated as there are in the adult, but I would be surprised if they would not have a function reward. But they do a reward prediction error or simply respond to rewards. I don't know either, because the reward prediction error is something that comes from the neural connectivity, from the inputs to the dopamine neurons. And they are probably not totally, they're certainly not totally matured, and I don't know if at all function. So I don't know if they would have a reward prediction error. That we cannot test, because we would need a living baby and look at the brain. That is not possible at the moment. There's no way of doing that.
You mentioned at the beginning that at least compared to other areas of the cortex, the reward system matures relatively early. And I've heard some arguments that during adolescence is when it matures, and specifically that you see increased levels or maybe increased receptor density specifically during adolescence, and then dopamine receptor density or sensitivity decreases into adulthood. Is that consistent with your understanding?
Yeah, I would not be surprised, because beginning the brain remodels itself, it produces connections that it loses. The connection, of course, needs vesicles and receptors and everything. Yes, no, that would work perfectly well. I would have no problem.
Why would it go up during adolescence and then later decrease during adulthood?
The general idea is, this is something general for all neural connections. There are more connections formed that will be stabilized in longer life. And one of the ideas I heard was that there is no particular building plan for the neural connections in the genes. The plan is simply connect with whatever I can find with, and only that will be used properly and will be necessary, will survive, and the rest will disappear. So it's not a plan of a one-to-one connection genetically, which would need a lot of genes. It's more like a plan, connect what you can find with, and we'll see what will work, and the rest will disappear. It's a much, much easier principle. I don't know if that's the only explanation of this transient pruning or transient higher number of synapses that disappear, but that's at least one argument I've heard.
What was interesting to me about this unique argument for reward sensitivity during adolescence is that, unlike regular pruning, where you might have more neurons during childhood that then prune during adulthood and the remaining connections get stronger, it wasn't just that linear decrease. It was smaller number of connections during childhood that raises during adolescence and then later prunes in adulthood. So it's like an inverted U-shaped argument.
Yeah. The connections will not form all within the first years. They're not there when the baby is born. The dendrites in the frontal cortex are not very mature when the baby is born. When the dendrites are not mature, they don't attract much axons. The axons form later, but then maybe too many form and they disappear afterwards. So it's an inverted U-shape. Yes, because birth, not everything is there that needs to be there. The neurons themselves are there, but they still have axons that grow slowly. Then they contact. Some contacts will be stabilized, other contacts will disappear. And that takes days, weeks. The front cortex takes 25 years or something like that, until you get a stabilized network.
We talked briefly about how increased reward sensitivity during adolescence could relate to increased risk-taking. And some people, especially evolutionary psychologists, make an argument that this is adaptive. So there's something about that period of sexual maturation where you want to be especially sensitive to reward and to exploration, and it's adaptive that it later decreases. And then another possibility could be something like it's just a spandrel. Something about the brain development needs there to be this peak with increased sensitivity in order to have that pruning, but it's not specifically selected for in an adaptive way.
No, I don't know. That's a hypothetical answer. I don't know. Maybe you're too sensitive. I'm not sure you're too sensitive to reward. You have a totally different attitude as an adolescent. And the risk taking is only a part of your exploratory behavior, if you don't explore things, you get stuck with what you have. And that is fine when you're 60 years old or 70 years old, you're happy with everything you got. But when you're 10 years old, you want to explore the world. You want to see what's going on. If you already know at 10 years old what you want, my God, what a boring life. You want to expand your ideas. You want to try out things. You will try out 50 things. One of which will work, will be fantastic. And the other 49 you can forget. That's called exploration. That happens also with irrational behavior. When you do lots of bullshit mistakes, you do a lot of damage. You lose a lot of time, but you might inadvertently run into a situation that is extremely powerful, helpful. That one situation makes worse all these other 49 mistakes you're doing. You want to be expansive when you're young. You want to try out everything. Children play. The children's play is not because they're stupid. The children's play is a very smart program to understand, explore the world, and see what you can do in the world. If you observe children, well, any time between the age of when they become a bit more independent, 1 or 2 years old, when they start walking, what they all explore compared to a 6-year-old, they never explore. I'm exaggerating. They explore much less than children. And everybody goes nuts with these children that always take their electric train apart instead of letting it run in circles. They take the electric train apart because they want to understand the engine, the electric motor. And they take it apart, of course they can't put it back together and the whole thing falls apart because they don't have the experience. But in doing so, they learn ultimately how to approach a problem, maybe even how to understand electric motor, but at least how to approach a problem, not just sit there and say, no, nothing can be done, I'm doomed. No, they go and say, let's go and try this. Let's try this. Ultimately, one of these, well, only 1 out of 50 or so may succeed and they learn something. And the children, they seem to do that 15 hours a day or something, all the time. It's amazing. We don't have time. We don't have the interest. We don't even have the energy. And that's because they want to build up their world and they want to build up their brain. Because whatever they're doing, they're training them. Whatever we do changes your brain. Our discussion changes your and my brain. Whatever anybody does changes their brain. The children want to train their brain, not consciously. But it happens. Children that individuals that as young children try to train their brain have a higher chance of survival in evolution and reproduce in evolution. Those that don't train their brain, you don't see them anymore. They have disappeared because they got lost during their lifetime. Evolution has millions of years to work.
There's a machine learning analogy here of you could get stuck in a local optima and then any gradient descent in any direction is going to exactly decrease prediction, even though there could be a global optimum somewhere else.
And behind the mountain is a higher safe net. Yes.
Uh-huh. So you need noise or exploration, and that's
and big time.
Social jump mammals. High,
occasionally jump high and you'll follow the mountain or something. So erratic change. 1 out of 50 times we jump a bit higher and you look over the mountain. Oh, there's a higher level. So let's go there. Yes, exactly.
If you think about play, especially in social mammals, spend so much time playing, it can be confusing from a survival of the fittest perspective, because you might think, why are you running around wasting energy? Isn't it better to conserve energy for survival's sake? But the argument here is that through play, you're practicing and calibrating your reward system and learning to engage socially.
So social engagement is far more complicated than the dopamine reward system, right? You need a lot of cortex to understand other people. The mind understand other minds. The dopamine neurons, they just respond to a reward. Somewhere, some neurons detect that this is a reward and not just a neutral sensory stimulus. Okay, you need to have that. But once you have that, the neurons just respond passively. Social interaction is unbelievably complicated if you think about it. And you need the cortex. And if it's complicated, you need a lot, much longer training. If I claim that the dopamine neurons are almost doing their job from birth on, maybe not exactly as we see it in the adult animal, almost there, the human cortex is no way social competent at even at age 5 or 10, right? So that takes a lot more training. The cortex is much more complicated, take more training, the situation is more complex, you need a more complex machinery to do that.
We've been talking about reward very generally, but there are different facets of reward. So there would be reward sensitivity or sensitivity to magnitude of different reward or different qualitative rewards like monetary or food or sex. Are these all using different brain systems or is it one domain general dopamine reward system?
The dopamine system is domain general, but as you mentioned, different rewards, there are certainly sensory systems that makes a difference. You need to identify the reward and then you need to compute the value of that reward. The value of that reward is tied with the dopamine, but the neurons do not distinguish between, I don't know about sex, but I would think so, don't distinguish between sex and a drop of fruit juice. They only say how good it is. That is called the value or the subjective value. That's all they do. You need other brain areas, mostly the cortex, at least in humans, that tell you what is the actual reward.
In that sense, dopamine neurons, they're more affective. They're generating that positive or negative emotional experience, and the cortex is interpreting things in a cognitive, contextual way.
I'm not sure dopamine neurons are involved in the affective responses. I don't know. I would think be more the amygdala. I think it's more basic. It's the value. The value is how much a reward is good for you, how much it helps you to survive today, and how much it helps you to propagate your genes, that is, to have mating partners. That's the value. You infer, you cannot measure that value, that's famous value, but you can infer from choices. What you choose more frequently or what you prefer has, by definition, a higher value. That's the definition of value. That's what they do, the value, and they do it in this reward prediction era manner, right? They don't tell you what the reward is, and they don't tell you what you need it for. They only care how good it is or how bad it is. Not bad in the sense of being aversive, but it can be very low value and very high value. Very low value, I would say, is bad, and very high value is very good. But they're not interested in paying or fear.
Could you explain the functional organization of the dopamine system across different brain areas? I often see it as a circle beginning at the brainstem and projecting upwards to the cortex, and then the cortex projects back to the brainstem in this cyclical process.
It's a bit more than brainstem. It's in the midbrain. Mm-hmm. That's the basis of the brain. Yeah, the dopamine neurons have their cell bodies in the midbrain and the ventral lower part of the midbrain. And project the axons into the striatum, the basal ganglia, mostly putamen and caudate nucleus, and to a good extent also into the cortex. And these areas feedback. The reward systems, when you look at them completely, are totally reciprocally interconnected. That means the reward neurons, the dopamine reward neurons go to cortex, the cortex reward neurons go to dopamine. And maybe other cortex neurons also go to dopamine. Dopamine neurons are also connected to amygdala. Some dopamine neurons project into the amygdala, and the amygdala neurons project back into the dopamine. The same thing with the striatum. Dopamine neurons go to striatum and go back to the striatum. And then, of course, the frontal cortex reward neurons are connected to amygdala, to the amygdala. I'm not sure they're all reward neurons. And they go in both directions. So you have a little network between dopamine neurons, striatum, autonomic cortex, and amygdala. These are the four principal reward circuits that are interested in reward without anything else. But all reward structures, except the dopamine neurons, are also having other neurons that are identifying the different types of reward, like juice reward, food reward, and sexual rewards.
Is the cerebellum involved at all?
Maybe. There are some indications that there are plenty of neurons that are sensitive to reward in many brain areas. But when you look closely at that, they're often in association with movements or with sensory stimulation. For example, the parietal cortex, very famously, has neurons with reward that are driven by reward, but they're also driven with movements. And so they could have a combination of excitation due to reward and to movement. The same thing in some neurons in the striatum, the same thing. Other neurons in the striatum are purely reward. So this, what I call the reward system, contains neurons that are only interested in reward, but reward influences a large number of brain areas. And as I said, often in association with other things like stimuli or movements. But reward is processed in large areas in the brain.
A prediction in particular seems to rely on memory. So I imagine there's also some hippocampus involvement there.
I don't know that. Could be. But prediction, predictive responses to dopamine neurons. And where does the prediction come from? Maybe from the frontal cortex, from the latum. The hippocampus, I don't know. The predictions are built in a very, within a second or so. Whether the hippocampus, I'm sure there are neurons in the hippocampus that follow predictions in a second rhythm. But to me, it's more a long-term memory thing or more an organizational memory, spatial memory, and things like this. I think the minute-by-minute or second-by-second prediction that we see in all subneurons is also coming from striatum and orbital cortex. Not sure about anything. I don't know.
So what is happening?
There are probably some studies that show prediction responses in the amygdala, but how representative that is for the whole structure, I don't have a full picture of that.
At the neuronal level, when predictions change, what is happening? What does it mean for a neuron to have a prediction? It almost implies that it has memory. Is that stored somewhere?
It implies that the neuron receives information from memory. The neuron responds to a stimulus that predicts a reward. All right, let's say I wave a banana to you, and that banana predicts reward, even if you don't get it right now. The banana is a typical reward predicting stimulus. Your memory somewhere understands this is a banana. I've seen that. I know that. I can give a name and everything. That's not what the dopamine neurons do. But the dopamine neurons will respond to that banana. If I suddenly show you, where's my hand? I'm trying to find my hand. My hand comes. And let's say my hand is a banana. Suddenly, that would fire a dopamine neuron. The memory that this is a banana is not in the dopamine neuron. I don't know. What is in the dopamine neurons is the value that this prediction has for you or for me. Yeah, I think that's basically it. It has access to a memory. This dopamine neuron has access to a memory, is influenced by that memory. I don't know. I don't think the dopamine neuron is storing this memory content. I don't know. I'm not sure what I'm saying now. Getting too complicated. I don't know.
Let's talk about addiction and the role dopamine plays in that. I hear a lot of evolutionary arguments in particular that there's a mismatch between our ancestral environment and our modern day environment, where, for example, foods high in fat and sugar used to be very rare and therefore evolved to be rewarding because of their high energy content. But nowadays, they're so abundant and they're bad for us, and a lot of people struggle with that. Or other things that are designed to be addictive, like gambling or video games or smartphone usage, all these things you can name that we get sucked into. And people often use this terminology of it's hijacking our dopamine system. Does that hijacking phrase sound right?
I'd say the dopamine system has evolved over millions of years. Most of the time, until 100 years ago, if you take the example of cat, we were doing hard labor. 80-90% of us were farmers. Then they became factory workers. They had the energy consumption of 6,000 to 8,000 calories a day. They could not get the calories, proteins, and from sugars, from carbohydrates. They needed to eat fat. And that is how evolution works. A brain that does not recognize fat as a calorie containing and providing, that brain has no chance of survival. And individuals with such a brain would have disappeared. They don't exist anymore. So what we see now is animals and humans, in particular now humans, as we're talking with them, that for whom the reward system is particularly tuned to fat, not only the dopamine neurons. I don't know that about dopamine neurons specifically. We haven't looked at that. But the current humans place a very high reward value into fat. And it would probably take many generations in which humans do not need that fat anymore until the valine fat decreases for the gray neurons. Right? You would need a mutations basically in the brain in which the fat loses its attraction for the reward neuron. And evolution goes very slowly. We're 80 generations away from Jesus. We basically have the same brain as Jesus. There are about 8 mutations per human generation. And many of these mutations have actually no consequence. Others are terrible. And others produce a progress in the evolution of our gene. Right? So we are extremely slow in changing ourselves, our brains and everything. And if the industrial revolution, or whatever we call it, the modern life has advanced so fast, it really out our evolutionary speed. And of course, the reward neurons, or the rewards, the fat reward, is detected by dopamine. Not only by dopamine. The dopamine neurons are, by all means, probably the most consistent and strongest reward neurons in the brain. So if you want to focus on dopamine neurons by saying hijacking the dopamine system, it's probably not wrong, but it's not only dopamine neurons that determine that fat is a good reward. You certainly have, over the frontal cortex, you have amygdala. There are neurons in the amygdala that specifically detect fat. Our reward system is not adapted to our current situation, and it can only adapt through evolutionary process, basically through mutations, gene mutations, of which there are 8 per generation, and the generation 25, 30 years or something. The gambling thing, the addiction to iPhone or telephone and media is still a little different thing, which I can explain. But this obesity is at least what comes to mind here when I talk about the attractiveness or the reward value of fat.
That makes sense. And how about the technology addiction?
Yeah. The funny thing is the dopamine neurons do not only respond to reward. Puzzles a lot of people and creates a lot of confusion. The dopamine reward response is preceded by 50 to a couple of hundred milliseconds by an unspecific response that only detects the stimulus without having identified whether it's a reward or not. So they respond very well to aversive stimuli. But they only detect the stimulus as such, like this is a stimulus. That when I'm doing this, I'm producing stimuli right now. May not be strong enough to fire dopamine neurons, but the dopamine neurons respond to aversive stimuli, but not to the aversiveness. They simply respond to detection or to the appearance of the stimulus. And as soon as the neurons have understood it's not a reward, the response decreases immediately, goes into inhibition often. But this initial response, if that is strong enough, it will release dopamine. It's a dopamine response. And this released dopamine can have the same effects as reward. It means plasticity and learning. So if you have a strong enough neutral stimulus, like something on the TikTok or so, that could fire, that would most certainly fire dopamine neurons, and it can have a plasticity effect. And if you have too much dopamine firing, then you get addiction. So you could have in some brains, not at all, other brains, you could have addiction. I don't get addicted to that stuff. I walk in the US or in Puerto Rico into hotels, have slot machines, click directly next to the reception, and I don't react. I hear it, and I'm not interested. And colleagues that come up with me, they immediately jump to these machines. So people have different brains. Not everybody gets addicted to TikTok. Some people get addicted to TikTok. Some people don't even look at TikTok, or they look at it and don't care for it, right? So the brains are different between everybody. But in some cases, the suspected dopamine release from these very intense stimuli can produce dopamine release. The dopamine release can then have produced addiction if it's too strong. Not everybody gets addicted to cocaine either. Brain got to be sensitive or have particular strong dopamine responses or strong receptor response.
I'm thinking about the prediction in my brain going on looking at your camera right now, whereas the lighting has dimmed down, your body is appearing to just appear back and forth like a phantom darkness. And yes, so it's
let me switch on.
It was actually very illustrative because even though the raw sensory stimuli are strange, it's something that I'm so easily able to contextualize as this is just the Zoom call. Your body is there statically and not changing. It's just a perceptual illusion based on the lighting.
Yeah. But an illusion is perception of the light, of the color, or the intensity of my face, for example. Yeah, it's 4:30 local time and it's dark outside. You can see it outside.
Is there any dopamine neuron action involved there where, for example, there are perceptual neurons perceiving you and expecting a certain outline? And if that outline is blurry or fidgety, then there's any prediction error involved there?
If the outline is a reward, and if that fuzzy outline looks like less of a reward, yes, you would have a negative prediction. Mm-hmm.
In a subtle way, now that the camera is well lit and showing your face in HD again, that's rewarding in its own way.
So if my face were an apple and you couldn't see it very clearly, you were unsure it was an apple, I go switch on the light and suddenly the apple appears like that, you would have a heartbreaking response. That's precisely what I meant by the temporal sensitivity, because suddenly the apple becomes visible. Oh, here's my apple. Within 30 seconds, it's clear. Then you would have a nice dopamine response. Yes.
And this domain generality.
If it turns out it's a power tomato, then you would have a negative dopamine response. As soon as you understand it's a power tomato.
Mm-hmm. And it's domain general enough that whether that's food or a social reward, like seeing an individual's smile, all of this is activating essentially the same system.
The social reward, yes. There have been studies on social reward, but it's more like the reward was given to another animal. I forgot the data. I'm not sure it fires social neurons. The face of social reward has never been tested on dopamine. So we were looking at, we were analyzing, we're showing movies, King Kong and Indiana Jones to monkeys. It turned out that monkeys perceived as reward, they did reactions are typical for reward, but you never got around for reporting from neurons. That was the idea initially. But they do so little, they have so little reward value that you wouldn't get enough data out. That was the conclusion. But social stimuli have reward function for animals.
Monkeys watching a movie like Indiana Jones, do they also show the same effects? Let's say there's an action chase scene, and in humans, you'd see increased heart rate or something like that. Do the monkeys respond the same way?
I don't know, but I would think so. They were glued. They had to touch a lever. And as soon as they released the lever, it was over. Oh, yes. They were glued to the lever.
Uh-huh.
Yes, they liked that. But when we had make the movement to touch a lever, they did not more than 5 or so movements in 15 seconds. And that's not enough for us to get data.
Close talking about your recent work on risk-taking that you were mentioning earlier?
Yeah. Oh, you ran into risk because it's a way of assessing subjective reward value. And the idea is the reward, small and large rewards are not necessarily, a large reward is not necessarily better than a small reward. For example, you ate it. Then people refer to that as subjective reward value. That means the subjective value goes down with satiety. We mentioned that earlier. But the physical amount of reward is the same. So if you want to claim that the dopamine neuron responds to a reward that is meaningful to the animal, you need to show that they're coding subjective reward and not just reward amount. Because the amount, as my satiety example shows, is not always important for the animal. What is important is how the animal values itself, that reward. If the animal is thirsty, the reward is higher value. And one way to show that is through risk. And it's actually more complicated. There is a very good definition, economics, about subjective value, which is called utility. And you can get utility, you can have a mathematically defined utility, because we're working with very precise behavior here, very precise neural recordings. We want to have precision and we want to have mathematical definitions of subjective value. And one of those is utility, the formal economic, mathematically defined utility functions, and to assess those functions, one of the two main ways is to go through risk, because risk modifies the subjective value, right? If you're a risk avoider and I present you the same reward as a riskier reward or a safe reward, you get the same mean reward, you will prefer the safe reward. You would even prefer less safe reward than the riskier reward because you hate that risk, right? So risk defines subjective reward value very much. So we talked about that. We worked on that with economists, and that works perfectly. The dopamine neurons are coding the subjective reward value very much. They code whole utility functions.
So this is related to Kahneman's loss aversion bias, where whether it's risk or whether it's loss, we're more sensitive to that, even if the expected utility, even if we're making an irrational decision looking at expected utility.
The irrational decision, the definition of rationality here probably hinges on the reward amount. And when you are a risk avoider, you are going for less reward if it is under the condition it's not risky. So you are foregoing larger rewards. You can call that irrational. I would not call that irrational. The definition of irrationality in economics is subjective value, the maximization of subjective value. And this is a risk avoider going for smaller rewards is still maximizing the utility, the subjective value. So I would not call risk avoiding or risk seeking irrational behavior. And the other aspect in irrational behavior is interesting to bring that up. The other aspect is that when we define rationality by maximization of subjective value, not objective value, when we define it by maximization of subjective value, then your subjective value and my subjective value may not be the same. Most likely they're not. The dogma in economics is your utility function and my utility function cannot be compared. You cannot feel how much I put utility into an apple or something. Well, I derive how much utility. Just as a famous economist once said, you do not feel my toothache. You can only see that I have a toothache, but you don't really feel it. You don't know how intense it is. The irrationality is the same thing. What seems utility maximization for me may not be utility maximization for you. And then you say, I'm irrational because I'm not maximizing utility in the same way you would do that. So this is the last conclusion. My rationality and your rationality are different. And so saying you are or that I am irrational from your point of view is just basically meaningless. You're not behaving the way I'm not behaving the way you would behave or vice versa. But to say that is irrational, I'm not so sure. I'm overly emotional, and you say emotion is the opposite of rational, yes, then you can say it. I wouldn't do that.
Do we have a sense of the source of these individual differences or the directionality where, for example, you have genetic differences in sensitivity of certain dopamine neurons, and that leads you to take a more reward-sensitive attitude, as opposed to something like you consciously adopt a different strategy, and then because of neuroplasticity, that changes the way your brain responds?
I don't know. I think that's a fair question, and the answer is probably yes. I just don't know it, and I don't know if everybody knows. Well, come back to my gambling experiment. I pass a slot machine in a hotel reception. I have nothing. My colleague goes there and gets addicted, and pulls this thing all the time, right? In his opinion, I'm irrational because I'm not gambling. I'm not going to my best subjective value. For him, the gambling has highest subjective value. He loves that risk. Okay, I don't. So for him, I'm irrational. For me, that guy is, or that person is irrational because he or she is wasting all their money with the stock machines, which you know, they usually waste their money, right? Why is that? Why is this other person gambling? I'm not gambling. I'm sure I have different numbers and concentration of receptors, dopamine receptor, GABA, glutamate, all receptors, different numbers of neurons, totally different connections, not totally, but different fine connections. Yes, brains are different.
I love this work because of how it applies at literally all levels of analysis, from understanding neural firing all the way up to understanding abstract economic motivations underlying decision-making and really everything in between.
The visual psychophysicists long debated whether the red for you is the same red as for me. We see a particular wavelength and we call that red. Do we really see it the same way? It's impossible. It's just like my and your toothache. We cannot compare it. And the same thing is the subjective value. And then to say that it looks like your red is different than mine, therefore you're irrational, I'm not irrational. I don't think I want to do that.
Do you think there's an attraction to those types of philosophical questions that can never be answered because it's a never-ending journey?
Yes. Never-ending journeys are very interesting. You always have a new argument. 3 years ago, I would have not had that argument about irrationality, but I've thought about it. And I have a son who works in neuroeconomics as well. We've been discussing this. And I've discussed it with other people. This, your toothache is not my toothache. It comes from a very famous economist who told about somebody else. And things develop. I think these interact. Problems, including the famous consciousness, will keep us busy for a long time and will be very interesting.
And they're all very rewarding.
Have consequences. If you think somebody else is irrational, you're more bound to burden. And if you respect that they are simply different than you are, then you probably respect them. And you may not wage a war against people like that.
Thank you very much for your time, Wolfram.
Okay. It was fun to talk to you. It's very similar.
You as well. Very rewarding.
You know,